Okay. Revelation 5. 11:20. Now, we're going to come back and look at a couple of pieces that I didn't cover in detail last week. We have this scene in heaven. Revelation 4 is about, gives you the picture of the one who is seated on the throne. And remember, the one who is seated upon the throne has a scroll in his right hand. There's a lot of worshiping going on. The one who is seated upon the throne is deemed worthy because it is through the one on the throne. The one on the throne has created all things, and by his will they exist. Then in chapter 5 it opens with this image of the one seated upon the throne with the scroll in his hand. And we pick up here. I'll just start with 5:1. Then I saw on the right hand of the one seated on the throne a scroll written on the inside and on the back, sealed with 7 seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?" And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep bitterly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its 7 seals." Now, I suggested that a scroll with 7 seals is a bit unusual. You don't need that many seals. 7 being the number of completeness. Scrolls of this nature normally containing something of the future. We put those two together, and what we probably have in the scroll is not just something that's going to be in the future, but the end, the consummation of history. History, in a sense, is coming to its climax, or you might even say creation is coming to its climax. And the drama here is we are looking for one who is worthy to open this scroll and to look into it. In other words, to make known its contents, and in that sense, to put them in effect. And John is weeping because no one is found worthy in heaven or on earth or under the earth. And one of the elders, and remember, we've got so far in the picture, got the throne, the 7 spirits that are before the throne, the 4 living creatures, and then we have 24 elders. So one of these elders looks at John and says, do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its 7 seals. Now, these two expressions, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, or the Lion of Judah, and the Root of David, would have evoked for a first century Jewish person certain messianic expectations, certain hopes for a Messiah who would come. And I've mentioned before that in the first century there were a number of different expectations for an anointed figure, a Messiah simply being someone who is anointed by God for a particular task. But by the time of the first century there were a number of expectations for Messiahs. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, we see a group of people who are actually looking for 2 messiahs, a kingly messiah in the line of David, and a high priestly messiah. And as you read them, the high priestly messiah is a little bit higher up on the scale. And what you get there is probably the sense of, you know, at times when the king and the priests were the same figure, things didn't go so well, so we need kind of a division of powers. And for the people who are responsible for the Dead Sea Scrolls, seems to be that one of their concerns wasn't just that Gentiles are ruling over Israel, but that we've got some really poor high priests running the temple. And this, I think, is significant because what you find is a lot of the messianic expectations that you have in the first century weren't simply because Israel was under foreign occupation. That was obviously a big issue. But a bigger issue, or at least equally as big, was the fact that Israel's own rulers, because it was Jewish people who were high priests, weren't really doing their job the way they were supposed to be doing. So there was a dissatisfaction over foreign occupation, and also among those, in a sense, they might have even been thought of as traitors, those who were in power during the occupation. Now, so in Qumran, in the Dead Sea area, we have this expectation for two messiahs, a priestly messiah, a Davidic messiah, kingly messiah. There were some other expectations that there would be a prophet, maybe a prophet like Moses, who would come. Maybe even a prophet like Elijah, or Elijah himself would come. But the expectation that was probably the most prominent, and that we get most reflected in the New Testament, is the expectation for a king in the line of David. And these two expressions, the Lion of Judah and the Root of David, are intended to evoke this hope for a kingly Messiah, a Davidic Messiah. The expression Lion of Judah comes right out of Genesis 49. This is at the very end of Genesis. Everybody, Israel or Jacob and his children have all moved down to Egypt. Joseph has brought them down there. Jacob is on his deathbed and he is pronouncing blessings upon his sons. And so in 49, beginning at 8, you get Judah. Now Judah doesn't head the list because he wasn't born first. And hold that in mind because that'll be significant later on in the hour. But in 8, this is the blessing that Jacob, or Israel, gives to Judah. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He crouches down, he stretches out like a lion, like a lioness who dares rouse him up. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and the obedience of the peoples is his. Binding his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he washes his garments in wine, and his robe in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. So basically, Joseph had all of these dreams about the brothers bowing down to him. The promise now is to Judah that basically you are going to be the leader of Israel. The scepter shall never depart from Judah. And of course, Jerusalem is located within Judea or the tribe of Judah. Nor the ruler's staff from his feet. Notice at 8, your brother shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. So you have a lot of strong statements about the tribe Judah. And in the first century, when you have stuff like this, and let me back up one more time. In 2 Samuel 7, God promises David that there will be someone from your house, one of your descendants, will be on the throne forever. I am giving you an eternal kingdom. David was not from the tribe of Judah. He was from the tribe of Benjamin, but his headquarters were moved to Judah, and it was the southern kingdom of Judah that kind of held sway over everything. Well, what do you do if you're an oppressed people under foreign occupation and you have promises, these lavish promises to David that one of your ancestors will always be on the throne? What do you do when you're reading your scriptures and you have this passage in Genesis? Well, in first century Judaism, in leading up to then, these sorts of passages led to the understanding that God would one day send a Messiah, and it would be a kingly Messiah. And a couple of things would happen. Israel would be united under this Messiah, and all the Gentile rulers would be thrown out. And in fact, this is what David did. David was the second king of Israel, the first one being Saul. And the reason why the people, you heard this story, the people going to Samuel the prophet and saying, we want to be like other nations, we want a king. Why? Because all these other nations with kings are beating up on them. Israel by this time, through most of Judges, is kind of a tribal confederacy. I mean, and it's more like the individual tribes had their militia, but there was no central government. There was no gathering together into kind of one unit. And so God raised up different people called judges, who were mostly military leaders to lead Israel against their enemies. But Israel's just kind of, it's, you know, one step forward, two steps back sort of deal. The promised land isn't really as turning out like they had hoped it would be. And really the Philistines are just annoying. You know, they are always coming and you know, pillaging and all of this sort of thing. So it's finally, we want to be like other nations, give us a king. And there's a whole debate there, and God eventually says, okay, you can have a king, but realize you're rejecting me as king over you, and kings are not good things. But I'll let you have one. And they chose Saul, and Saul was pitiful, and so God chose their next king. He chose David, because David was a man after God's own heart. But he still warned them, this is not ideal. You know, God hasn't finally been convinced that having a human king is the best situation. But he accommodates himself to Israel, even to the point of saying to David, I'm going to give you, you know, a covenant, an eternal covenant, that somebody will be on, one of your ancestors will be on the throne. But David, hold on just a second. But David is remembered for two things. He united Israel into a single nation, and he defeated Israel's enemies. And you know all of that stuff about Bathsheba and trouble with his family and all of that? That was the second half of David's life. If you read the Samuel stuff, it's amazing. I mean, David is right on, and you know, and he's defeating everybody and all of this, and great things happen, and then his life becomes pretty pitiful later on. But he's remembered for uniting Israel and defeating Israel's enemies. And those are built into first century Jewish messianic expectations. And so the two words that I think characterize first century hopes was there was a militarism and nationalism. Israel would be restored as a nation. The 12 tribes would be gathered back together as a single nation, and that would involve military conquest against Israel's Gentile overlords. What?
David was promised the eternal dynasty.
Yes.
By God. Why?
Yes. Why?
What makes him so strong?
Because up to that point in the story, he had followed God faithfully. God had raised him up. He did what God told him to do.
So it was faith.
Huh?
Faith.
Yeah.
It was faith. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what I was trying to understand. Why, you know, what's the thing about this?
Yeah. And I think the other thing, too, is not just David's faith, but God's faith. God committed himself to David and stuck with it, even though that probably wasn't the ideal. You know, that wasn't God's ideal situation. And you get this sense of God accommodating. And he tells David, though. He says, now listen, you know, this, I'm not writing you a blank check. If you disobey me, you're going to be punished. And your children will be punished. But as long as they follow me, things will go well. Well, there's a bit of foreshadowing there.
What was so exceptional about them? What was different about them?
I think basically, if you were to boil it down to one thing, is that God chose David. I think that's what underlines the biblical witness, you know, and raising up of David. I mean, David is like Augustus for Israel. I mean, they went into a glory period. But I think from the biblical standpoint, a biblical viewpoint, is that just like Israel, there was nothing special about Israel. I mean, Abraham was faithful, but it becomes clear later on that God says, you know, I didn't choose you because you guys were great. I chose you because I decided to choose you, and I committed myself to you, and I'm not going to break my promise, even if you break yours. And so, by the first century, you have these expectations. God's got to do something. I mean, if God is going to keep God's promises, God has got to do something. The nation is in disarray, and we're being oppressed. So the solution is a military one, that God will anoint the Messiah, and the Messiah will come and wipe everybody out, or the Messiah and God's angels together. And a lot of Jewish expectations, you don't really have a lot of what the people of God are going to do. Sometimes you get the sense that the people of God are going to participate in this war, but a lot of times it's more of this kind of holy war thing that God is going to do with God's Messiah and God's angels. So this language of the Lion of Judah and the Root of David, for a first century person, would have evoked the idea of a holy war at the end of history engaged in by God and God's Messiah. Then, and I've said this before, this is not news, when John, he hears the elders say, don't weep, it's the Lion, you know, because the Lion of Judah has conquered, the Root of David has conquered, and he's worthy to open the scroll. When John actually turns to look, what does he see? He sees a lamb slain. And you get, later on you get the statement in 9, they sing a new song. This is probably a victory song. What you would imagine at the end of a triumph, a battle. Yeah. You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slaughtered, and by your blood you ransomed for God saints from every tribe and language and people and nation, and you have made them to be a kingdom and priests serving our God. Now, if the Lion of Judah evokes the expectations for a military victory that would lead to restoration of the nation, notice what the Lamb does. The Lamb, through sacrificial death, creates what? Saints? From where? Every tribe and language and people and nation. So, In a very, I don't know if it's subtle, it's actually quite, it's implicit, but in a very stark way, John evokes holy war imagery and language and expectations, and with a turn, transforms them into something else. We have military conquest. Now, we, instead of militarism, we have self-sacrifice. And instead of the ultimate goal of that being nationalism, we now have an international community of people who are now a kingdom. And this language here, you've made them to be a kingdom and priests serving our God, this is language of the Exodus. You know, the Passover lamb, and then they leave Egypt, and while they're on the way to Sinai, God is saying, I'm going to make you a kingdom of priests. And so a lot of Exodus imagery and Passover lamb imagery is being evoked here. And let me just read a couple of pieces from where I get all of this. The Climax of Prophecy by Richard Bauckham. The key point to be noticed is that in the contrast between what is said to John and what he sees, he first evokes the idea of the Messiah as the Jewish nationalistic military conqueror, and then reinterprets it by means of the notion of sacrificial death for the redemption of people from all nations. The juxtaposition of the contrasting images of the lion and the lamb expressed John's Jewish Christian reinterpretation of current Jewish eschatological hopes, end time hopes. And one of the things I think is important about this is that this image that we have in Revelation is not just a Christian, but a Jewish Christian. You wouldn't have gotten Gentile Christians writing a book like Revelation, because it's thoroughly Jewish. And just because it becomes Christian doesn't mean it's not Jewish anymore. All right? Particularly out in the first century when Christians were a Jewish sect. Let me continue. The vision of the slaughtered lamb recalls other Old Testament motifs. The lamb led to slaughter in Isaiah 53. Like a lamb led to the slaughter, you know, it's that servant song. And the Passover lamb is evoked. The portrayal of Jesus' death in these terms was already familiar in Christian tradition. But by placing the image of the sacrificial victim alongside those of the military conqueror, John forges a new symbol of conquest by sacrificial death. Let me read that again. By placing the image of the sacrificial victim alongside those of the military conqueror, John forges a new symbol of conquest by sacrificial death. Insofar as 5:5, the line of Judah stuff, expresses Jewish hopes for messianic conquest by military violence, 5:6 replaces those hopes. And insofar as 5:5 evokes narrowly nationalistic expectations of Jewish triumph over Gentile nations, 5:6 replaces those expectations. Insofar as the Jewish hopes rooted in Old Testament scriptures were for the victory of God over evil, 5:6 draws on other Old Testament scriptures to show how they have been fulfilled in Jesus. Jesus the Messiah has already defeated evil by sacrificial death. He has won a victory, but by sacrifice, not military conflict. And he has delivered God's people, that they are from all nations, not only Jews. The continuing and ultimate victory of God over evil, which the rest of John's prophecy describes, is the outworking of his decisive victory won on the cross. Now, one of the questions that you might have, is one that I had as we're going through this, if John is going to evoke military language and employ it, I mean, it doesn't stop here. He evokes it, he transforms it, but then he continues to use the military language. Why take that strategy? Why not get rid of the military language altogether? Any thoughts?
After all, I understand he was imprisoned at the time.
That's debated. He's on the island of Patmos.
Okay.
And the assumption is that maybe he's been exiled there because it's very ambiguous because what your point is, at the beginning of Revelation it says, you know, I was on the island of Patmos because of the witness of Jesus. And it's almost, you get the sense that he's been being a faithful witness, and so he's been exiled. Continue.
And so, you know, if he was jailed,
exiled, yes.
That you would be thinking in terms of some way to get yourself out and maybe any others that were with you.
Mm-hmm.
And the military language would be natural.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts on, you know, why retain the language if it evokes and it's open to misinterpretation, as there has been a history. What does the military language allow him to retain?
Is there a chance it's a bridge of connection?
In what sense?
Going back and meeting the people that understood the military model,
mm-hmm.
and then bringing them forward, kind of like Christ
did the law stuff and brought us into the love part.
Mm-hmm. That's a possibility.
Maybe the symbolism is there really is a struggle. There really is a confrontation that's occurring.
Mm-hmm.
It exists. And maybe that's reasonable. He's just recognizing the fact that there's a struggle.
Okay. So the sense is that, and that for John, there's a real holy war going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not only a holy war, that the Romans have completely destroyed everything in 70.
Mm-hmm.
And this was written after that.
Yeah, and so there's high feelings, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to be able to communicate to these people.
Well, and isn't that, I mean, Revelation plays that out.
Yeah.
You know, Jesus never messed with prayer. I think that's kind of a historical business, so I was going to just be for
mm-hmm.
But I think maybe to these people, that was like 9/11 times 100.
Yes.
I mean, it must have been amazingly huge in their mind what happened to Jerusalem.
Because one of the things is that in Jerusalem, if these are first century expectations, I mean, there were different views among Jewish people as to what the Messiah would do and how he would do it and how we as a people of God participate in that. And there was a group called the Sicarii, the dagger men is what they are called, who went around and said, listen, there is no king but God. In other words, you know, we're in an occupied situation. We should not have, you know, any dealings with the Romans whatsoever unless, you know, a knife is between us sort of deal. So when they went around and saying there's no king but God, they were saying we're supposed to overthrow him. And maybe even force God's hand to intervene. But by the time of 66 to 70 AD, if you're not familiar, this is a time when Jewish groups revolted against Rome, took over the temple, and Rome surrounded, sieged it, and eventually, I mean, there were campaigns all over Palestine. And eventually, 300 of these escaped from Jerusalem and went down to Masada. And Rome took a legion down there and laid siege for 2 to 3 years for 300 Jews? I mean, the amount of money Rome put into this is serious business. And guess what? The revolution failed. And it was probably inspired by these messianic holy war images. And one of the questions is, where in the world is God in all of this? And by the way, you Jewish Christian people, where were you during the war? Because they had skipped out. The Christian Jews did not participate in the revolt. This did not help relations between Jewish Christians and non-Christian Jews after the war, and probably one of the major reasons why there was a split.
Okay. Just real quick. My understanding of it is 67, they managed to overwhelm the local Roman garrison. And the Romans always had some local little group there
mm-hmm.
that could be overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
The model is, yeah, but if you do that, you know, it'll take time. It'll take time, but we're going to be back.
Mm-hmm.
The real guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and actually, I guess the guy leading it supposedly fell asleep during one of Nero's poetry readings. So his punishment was, that was his job, go fix it. So. But, you know, that's what they did. You have to be an example,
right? Mm-hmm.
You know.
Now, John, one of the things John wants to do is, see, he's brought us into heaven because we might have an earthly view of all of these goings on. John wants to give us a heavenly view, God's view of what's going on. And so there is a struggle between good and evil that John is wanting to portray. And he's wanting to show you the true nature. There is a holy war going on. I think this is why John retains this imagery of holy war imagery. Because there is a battle going on. Now, don't think that it's this kind of spiritual battle that takes place in spiritual places and doesn't have anything to do with human affairs. It's not that sort of battle. Yes, there are demons and things involved like that, but it's not the sort of spiritual warfare that you might get when you hear that talk today. Because Rome is being presented as one, essentially, who is animated by the forces of darkness. Eventually, and I don't know if we'll be able to touch on this, but there's a demonic trinity that appears in Revelation. You know, this beast, this dragon, and its prophet, and all of this. There's a demonic trinity, and it's an image of Rome, that Rome has set itself up in opposition to God and God's ways. So this is all political. So when we talk about a battle between good and evil, we're not just saying, oh, it takes place in another realm. It takes place in all of these realms, because heaven and earth aren't as distinct as you would think. So he says, there is a war going on, but here's the deal. It will not be won through military conquest. The Messiah, who has won the decisive victory, did not win that victory through military conquest. He has conquered, but he has conquered through his sacrificial death. Rome is not the true enemy, the force that animates Rome and its imperial policies. It's economic exploitation. It's idolatry. The temple cult in which the emperor was increasingly being understood as divine and demanding worship. You know, people used to say, yes, let's worship the emperor after they're dead. But then you had some coming along and saying, I'd kind of like that now. I mean, you know, why wait till I'm dead? So you have this thing, a number of things that would have really offended Jewish sensibilities. But John's wanting to say, first of all, John's wanting to say, yes, Jesus is the Messiah that you have been waiting for. So he doesn't want to give up on any of those messianic expectations, but he does want to transform them into a new symbol of conquest by sacrificial death. And it's important because one of the things that's fairly unique about this apocalypse, because there are other Jewish apocalypses about this time, at least the ones that have been preserved, you get very little detail in them as to, well, what are followers of the Messiah supposed to do, human followers of the Messiah. There's almost hardly anything mentioned, because it was kind of assumed, well, God's going to come with his angels and take care of all of this stuff. But in Revelation, there's a big emphasis upon human participation. This is why this apocalypse is all within a letter written to seven churches, and remember the seven messages. To the one who conquers, I will give this. To the one who conquers, I will do this. To the one who conquers. See, here's the dangerous part, it is a dangerous part. John is recruiting people for this holy war. And he's not just inviting them. He is telling them, you have been called into service. And to the one who conquers, these are the promises I am making to you. So while on one hand we can say, oh, we're thankful that the book of Revelation is not about a big military conquest at the end of history sort of deal, that we aren't being called to take up arms and go against our enemy, what we are being called to do is take up our crosses and to enter into this battle. There are people around this world who do believe that there's a holy war going on. And some of those groups are militant. And this is how they can get their members to strap on explosives and go and kill other people, because they recognize there is a war going on. Now, Christians, I don't think, can say, well, no, there's really not a war going on. For John, there is a war going on, and it's this sort of war. But how do we participate in it? We are called to conquer, but how? in the exact same way that the Lamb is called to conquer. Now, this reversal here of the picture of the lion as the lamb, next week we are going to see a picture of the lion's army. In fact, we're going to hear about the lion's army, and we're going to look and see what that army actually looks like. And you have the same evoking of military and use of military language, but a transformation of that. You know, yesterday it really hit me much stronger that, and I apologize, that now you know what you're being called to. I mean, it's not, it's a scary thing. I mean, this is serious sort of stuff. But we do have a model. And luckily we don't have to now figure out how to shoot weapons. I mean, there is a Dead Sea Scroll called the War Scroll. And it teaches you all that sort of stuff. It has military plans. I mean, it is arming people for a real, literal battle and getting them ready for that. And John is saying, yes, there is a real, literal battle coming. But if this is how God, through his Messiah, has won the decisive victory, that tells us everything about how we, as the Messiah's followers, will engage in that battle. And it is going to be through self-sacrifice. That is how God will transform the world. That is how God will bring the nations to know who he is. And recognize the difference in strategy. And this is, I mean, this I think is the exact same thing that Jesus was addressing in the Sermon on the Mount. Israel, you have been oppressed for about 400 to 500 years. You had a brief period of self-rule under the Maccabees. But basically, things have not been like they were when David was king. God is becoming king, and he is going to restore Israel's fortunes. But you cannot hope to pick up a sword and go against Rome and defeat Rome. One, they're too big. But two, it doesn't fit with God's vision for creation. How can you pick up a sword, go and kill a bunch of people, and then say, oh, no God? How can you be the light of the nation, the light of the world, and lead people to know the one true God with a sword in your hand? It doesn't work. What's going to be required is your life. And trust me, I will vindicate you. Those who lose their life for my sake will gain it. Well, blessings. Don't stop coming.
A friend of mine, I heard something about